So first, I just want to make sure that you can all see me and hear me. Does this sound okay? Okay. It's been pretty incredible leaving the retreat and then coming back in and feeling how much has changed. There's an incredible stillness. And I feel so grateful to be back here, actually. I feel very held by it and really inspired by the work that you've done in such a short period. I was also deeply touched by the interviews this afternoon that I had with many of you. Just really feeling your heart and sensing this this deep desire to be of service, and also this deep desire to be free. And so I want to invite you tonight, as I'm speaking, about stuff that might bring you into your brain a little bit more, into your head, to really continue with your practice. To invite in your whole body and your heart to listen and to keep returning to that. For me, that's been one of the most important pieces of this practice, is how do I bring the stillness and this deep listening and this tender heart into the work that I'm doing, as opposed to having them be separate. And so I invite that in each of us, and we support each other in it, in how to remain in our body, to keep listening to our hearts, even as we're engaging our analytical minds. I also want to take a moment and just acknowledge some of my teachers. I first want to thank Mark and Larry and Anna for inviting me to participate in this retreat. As I said on the first night, it's a real honor, and I feel very grateful. I also want to acknowledge Jack Kornfield, who's been a primary teacher for me, and Sylvia Borstein, John Kabat-Zinn, Tobin Giblin, Gary Schwartz, Roger Walsh, Shinzen Young, and my parents, Johanna and Dean Shapiro. And what I'd like to do is begin by inviting you to close your eyes and take a moment to think of someone who you're grateful for, someone who's touched your life in some way. And just bring this person into the room with you. Notice how it feels in your body. Good. And I'm curious, for how many of you was this a relatively positive experience? You can just raise your hand. Okay, so about everyone, which it normally is. So I like to begin with this partly out of gratitude and acknowledgement for our teachers, but also because research shows that when you're in a relatively calm and positive mood, you learn better. You integrate, you're able to retain information, you're able to recall it. And so it just kind of makes sense to start that way. I wish our whole education system was built around that framework, as opposed to instilling fear and punishment and consequences for not learning. So I want to go back to the first night when I asked you what your intention was for being here, and invite you again to reflect on what that is and what that's becoming. I'm sure it's evolving. And invite you to continue to listen to that deep intention. Often I'll have my students reflect on why they entered the field in the first place, once they're 1, 2, 3 years into graduate school, and just go back to that pure desire to be of service. When I reflected on my intentions for today, especially after the interviews that I had this afternoon, I really want to offer this. I really hope that it's of benefit to you and to the people whose lives you touch. It's such a gift for all of us to be in this profession. It's such a beautiful profession where it's so mutually rewarding. And to be on this journey with you and knowing that you're going to take everything that you experience here into the world and touch so many other people is really profound. So I really offer this, that it may be of benefit to all of us and to all the people who we work with. And then specifically, what I'm hoping to cover tonight is, one, just what is mindfulness? And I know that you've been receiving teachings in that, and I don't think anything I will say here is counter to what you've been learning, but I'll frame it more from the operational definition used in psychology. I'll talk a little bit about, is mindfulness helpful? And I'll be reviewing some of the research. And then lastly, how is it helpful? What's actually happening? What are the mechanisms of action? And again, I invite all of us to continue to be in our bodies, to keep our hearts open. Keep dropping back in if you want to close your eyes, if you want to physically touch your body. I sometimes, even when I'm teaching, will put my hand on my heart just to remember, because it's so easy to get lost. Okay, so as you're all familiar with, mindfulness has its roots in Buddhism. However, Western psychology and medicine has attempted to extract the essence of mindfulness so that it can be offered universally and can kind of transcend its religious and cultural roots. There are definite limitations to this, and I'm hoping later in the retreat, Larry will talk a little bit about the larger perspective and perhaps how to incorporate all of the Dharma into mindfulness, because mindfulness is just one small piece. However, the positive of extracting it out of its Buddhist roots was that it can be offered to many, many, many more people. And so, as I'll be defining it, is really as a universal practice and also a way of being. So the definition that we use, I recently co-authored a book with Linda Carlson called The Art and Science of Mindfulness, and the definition that we use in this text is the awareness that arises out of intentionally paying attention in an open, accepting, and discerning way. Okay. Intentionally, on purpose, paying attention in an open, accepting, and discerning way. And I'll unpack this a little bit. Out of this definition, you can derive three core elements of mindfulness. The first being intention. Why are we practicing? The second, attention. Bringing our awareness, our attention into the present moment. And then the third one is attitude, which is how are we paying attention? What is the quality of our attention? What is the attitude with which we're relating to our experience? And each of these is interwoven into the process of mindfulness, that they're not separate steps, but mindfulness arises out of this intentional attention done in a particular way. So I'll begin with intention, and I think what's interesting is when you think about mindfulness as it was originally taught in its context, the intention was really clear, right? The monks and nuns were devoting their lives to freedom, to liberation, to enlightenment, to being of service to all beings. And yet, when I'm working with patients, the intention isn't always so clear. And so what I find is really helpful is to begin with intention, no matter what that intention is. The intention could be to reduce my panic attacks, and I don't think that's any less valuable than enlightenment. But I think the idea of intention, of grounding this practice in your personal vision, and then to continue to return to it and see how it's evolving is essential. Jon Kabat-Zinn says this: your intention set the stage for what is possible. They remind you from moment to moment of why you are practicing. I used to think meditation practice was so powerful that as long as you did it at all, you would see growth and change. But time has taught me that some kind of personal vision is also necessary. So continuing to ask yourself, and I continue to ask my patients, what's your intention? And what's really beautiful to me is to watch how it evolves, that it might start with decreasing panic attack, which is, again, there's no value judgment on this, but then saying, oh, I want to be more present for my children. I really want to be here. Or I want to connect more with my body, or listen to my intuition, or know my heart, or be kinder. And their intentions evolve. As I said last night, I found the quote. Suzuki Roshi said it. He said, the most important thing is to remember the most important thing. I love this. It's so simple. And mindfulness helps us remember. So the second element of mindfulness in this definition is attention, which is simply observing, being present with our experience moment by moment as it's arising. As the Buddha said, yesterday is a memory, tomorrow is the unknown, and now is the knowing. As you all have experienced by now, you probably experienced it the very first evening, it's relatively difficult to sustain our attention in the present moment. Whenever I'm teaching meditation for the first time, my favorite question is, how many people notice that your mind wandered? And you get these very like shy hands, like kind of embarrassed to admit it. And then I say, look around. Everyone's hand should be, you know, sky high. You know, how many thousands of times did your mind wander? It's often referred to as monkey mind, right? That it's just swinging from limb to limb. And really, the mind has no shame. It goes wherever it wants to go. You don't have a lot of control over it. And so part of this practice is learning how to observe the mind, see where it goes, watch its patterns, and then consciously bring it back. That meditation is often referred to as a consciousness discipline. And it requires some discipline of bringing it back. The first night, I think it was Larry who said, mindfulness is about seeing clearly. The way we see clearly is by being fully here in the present moment. That if our mind is all over the place, right? Or if it's muddy, like he showed us with the water glass jar, it's hard to see clearly. As Germer says, he says, an unstable mind is like an unstable camera. We get a fuzzy picture. So part of this practice is learning how to bring our full attention into the present moment and really see clearly what's here. What's here right now? The third element is how we pay attention. And I was really grateful for Anna's teachings today during the metta practice of what qualities do we want to bring in? What medicine does our practice need? Can we bring in kindness? How are we relating to our experience? What I noticed when I was first learning this practice, I was in Thailand and I hadn't had a lot of experience. I'd read a little bit. And I decided to go on a 10-day Vipassana retreat at Wat Swan Mok. And the monk who was leading the retreat was this beautiful Thai man. And his English was hard for me to understand. And I didn't speak any Thai. And I kind of got that he said to pay attention to the breath going in and out of my nostrils. So for, you know, 18 hours a day, I was sitting there in 150-degree weather, somewhere around there. You know, with mosquitoes biting me, really paying attention. And I was getting more and more tense and more frustrated and more angry at myself. Like, why can't I do this? This is so just in, out, what's so difficult? And I just graduated from Duke University and school had been relatively easy and my mind usually did what I wanted it to do. And I was so frustrated. And about 5 or 6 days in, a monk from London came And I begged for an interview, and they said, okay. And I came to him, and I said, why is everyone doing this practice? They're crazy. It's horrible. I'm more tense than I've ever been in my life, and I hate all these mosquitoes, and I'm not allowed to kill them, and what? And he said, what's the quality of your attention? How are you relating to all of your experience? I was like, frustration, tension, judgment, striving. He said, so that's what you're practicing. And in that moment, I really got it, that the practice wasn't about how many breaths I could stay with during the day. It was, how was I relating to my direct experience? And could I hold all of it with kindness? With curiosity, huh, what does it feel like to not be in control of my mind? What does it feel like when there's agitation in my body? Can I hold all of that with a caring, kind, curious attention? Interesting, sadness. What does it feel like in my body? Anger, shame, loneliness. Instead of pushing all those experiences away or trying to manipulate and control them so that I could be perfect, it was a way of opening to all of it. And so in my writing, in academia, and in my teaching, I've really focused on this quality of attitude. And when I was first writing about this about 10 years ago, everyone said, you can't write about this in an academic text. I was writing my first book chapter. They said, you can't write about kindness and openness and gentleness, I think I even used that word, in this academic textbook. And I said, but if I don't, no one's going to understand this practice because it's not about just paying attention. So these were the qualities that we listed in our first book chapter, saying that these are really an essential part of the practice, and we offer them just as a heuristic. It's more a general quality as opposed to specifically cultivating each of these. But just like Anna was saying today, this idea of acceptance and openness and trust, kindness, non-striving, not trying to get anywhere or make anything happen, patience, letting go, non-reactivity. And as I've continued in my practice, one that's become particularly important is the sense of beginner's mind, of curiosity, of really inquiring into my experience. What does this feel like? As if it's the very first time I've ever felt it. I have this picture of my son, Jackson. I love that picture. So he really captures this sense of beginner's mind, this absolute, especially at this age, just genuine wonder and curiosity and awe at everything, the smallest little thing, the spider crawling across the floor. Incredible, right? A bite of his first strawberry. Spectacular. And really, when you approach life that way, everything does become extraordinary. All of a sudden, it is a miracle. Watching spring. Today, someone said, you know, they said not to look around while I'm doing walking meditation, just to really focus on my experience and not to notice the flowers and the breeze and the smell. And I said, oh, sweetheart, absolutely notice that. Take that in, feel it, breathe it in. That's your aliveness. And focus on the walking meditation, of course, and the instructions, and cultivate this one-pointed attention. But this is extraordinary and healing. And living life from that place where we're open and curious to whatever is arising is a gift. So these are the three elements, I believe, of mindfulness. And as we speak about it in psychology and academia, these are the three elements that I emphasize. So I'd like to shift now to the second intention for this evening, which is mindfulness helpful? Yes. They asked me not to get you two in your head, so I think I'll just move on, yeah? There's been 4 decades of research demonstrating both significant psychological and physiological effects. And what I'd like to do tonight is just very briefly summarize some of these and then talk a little bit about the research in cognitive neuroscience, which I think is the most interesting right now. So in terms of medical benefits, there's been some pretty extraordinary studies. One study that I still love, even though it's a couple years, many years old now, was a study that they did with patients with psoriasis, which, as you know, is a very uncomfortable skin disorder. And the traditional treatment for it is photochemotherapy, where you kind of stand in, you know, the old telephone booth looking contraption and you receive photochemotherapy. And so what they did was they randomly assigned people to the traditional treatment versus the control group. However, the traditional treatment versus the mindfulness added group. And what they did was they had people practice mindfulness and visualization while they were receiving the photochemotherapy. And what they found is that group, compared to the treatment as usual group, their psoriasis cleared over 33% faster. From just that small shift, everyone was receiving the exact same treatment, but just using and engaging their mind and body and hearts in that way had an extraordinary effect. There's also been a great deal of research for patients with chronic pain. And I think what's most interesting here is not everyone actually has their pain completely magically go away. People still report that they are in significant levels of pain. And yet, what you find is the way they relate to the pain is different. And their ability to work, to engage with their children, to lead a life full of activity completely shifts. And these gains, these improvements have been held 4 years after these studies are completed. They've been shown, mindfulness practice has been shown to decrease symptoms for patients with fibromyalgia, to decrease tension headaches, to decrease hypertension. And it's also been shown to enhance the immune system. Bless you. It's actually been shown to prevent the flu when people are given the flu vaccine and they've been practicing mindfulness in an 8-week mindfulness-based stress reduction course. Their antibodies, the way they respond to the flu vaccine, is very different and shows that they would be much less likely if exposed to get the flu than other people. It's also been shown to enhance immune functioning in people who have cancer. So both in people who aren't sick yet and people who are dealing with a severe illness. In terms of psychological and behavioral effects, mindfulness practice has been shown to decrease depression, to decrease anxiety and panic attacks, to decrease insomnia, to decrease binge eating, and to decrease substance abuse. And there's a lot of incredible, we'll talk a little bit on Wednesday, of just really innovative, pioneering interventions that are combining what we know in psychology about cognitive behavioral treatments for insomnia with mindfulness practices. What I think is interesting is that research demonstrates meditation decreases pathology. However, the original intentions, as I mentioned a few minutes ago, the original intentions of meditation were not to reduce hypertension and panic attacks, right? The original intentions were really for freedom and for cultivating greater compassion and liberation in our hearts and our bodies. Roger Walsh says, "We've put more focus on heart rate than heart opening." And I believe it's essential for meditation research to focus not only on decreasing pathology, although this is extraordinarily important and a lot of my research has focused on this, but also to balance this with increasing positive states and to look at what is the potential of meditation. How can we use this to really thrive in this world and help others thrive? So I also wanted to summarize the little research that's been done on this, and it's growing significantly. Meditation has been shown to increase self-actualization, self-efficacy, happiness. We have to question a little bit how they measured happiness, and I don't necessarily think it's from the Buddhist perspective, but still, it increases your sense of happiness, sense of control, your sense of spirituality and spiritual experience, empathy, that mildly important quality for therapy, yeah, and moral development. Meditation and mindfulness has also been shown to increase our cognitive capabilities. It's been shown to increase attention, concentration, creativity, and problem solving. It's been shown to increase both our short-term and long-term memory, and also our academic performance. I always make sure to show this slide when I'm speaking at medical schools and law schools. That tends to hook them a little bit more than the empathy one. Yeah, I'm teasing, probably not. Okay, so I want to talk a bit about this new research because I find this some of the most extraordinary research and also some of the most hopeful. So first I want to give you a little background about the brain. This is actually a photo from National Geographic in 2005, which is one of these llamas hooked up to the EEG monitors to measure the activity that's occurring in his brain, both while he's meditating and just while he's living his normal life. So some background information about the brain, and again, this has nothing to do with meditation yet, is we found that positive and negative emotions in the brain look different, and that you can find kind of the signature activity when you're feeling happy and enthusiastic and joyful and vital, that there is higher activity in the left prefrontal cortex relative to the right. And this is all based on a ratio. So higher activity with the left to right ratio means you're in a more joyful, alert state. And this isn't your left hemisphere versus your right hemisphere of the brain. So it's not, you know, the artistic side and the more intellectual side. This is just the prefrontal cortex, which is the Dan Siegel does a great job of explaining the brain, but the prefrontal cortex is this part right here, and then inside is the reptilian brain and the amygdala. So he says, you know, when you're having an argument, you flip your lid, and you no longer have any rational brain left to engage in the argument. You're just here in your reptilian brain, so not a good idea to have a conversation. But this is your prefrontal cortex. This is your lid. This is what allows you to be rational and think logically, all those things that might be important in a conversation. So when you're in a relatively depressed or anxious mood, then you have higher right to left prefrontal cortical activity. And actually, extreme right activity is associated with clinical depression, with anxiety, and post-traumatic stress disorder. Okay. So again, this has nothing to do with meditation. This is just what happens in the brain when you're experiencing different mind states. And you all have probably experienced all of these in the last few days. So they started looking at, they started asking the question, well, do the brains of meditators look different than just the average person? And so they had 175 subjects come into the laboratory. This was at University of Madison, Wisconsin. And they looked at their left to right ratio in the prefrontal cortex. And these are people who weren't meditating. And then there was a Lama, Tibetan meditator, visiting. And they said, you know, let's get him in here and see what his brain's doing. And he had the highest left to right activity of any of the 175 subjects. But it wasn't just like a little bit higher. It was so much higher that had they not kind of predicted it and had it be in their hypothesis, they would have thrown the data out as an outlier, like something went wrong with the machine. Further, while he was meditating on compassion, he was able to significantly increase this left-to-right ratio. So they wondered, is this just a random artifact of this particular meditator? Like, was he born this way, and that's why he chose to spend his life meditating tens of thousands of hours? Or does this reflect the effects of practicing meditation for decades? So they decided to do the gold standard in Western research, which is a randomized controlled trial, and they decided to use biotechnology employees. They figured if they could show it in them, anyone could do it. And so they randomly assigned them to the mindfulness-based stress reduction intervention, and Jon Kabat-Zinn led this. They wanted to get, you know, the founder leading it, so they had the best possible chance. And then to a weightless control group. And then they looked at their positive and negative moods. They looked at their prefrontal cortical activity using the EEG monitors. And they looked at their response to the flu vaccination. I need a drum roll here. If I was better with PowerPoint, I would have the sound in there, but I don't. Okay, so confirming past research that I've been sharing with you, positive emotions increased, negative emotions decreased, just like we've seen in the past few decades. What was extraordinary, though, is that at a four-month follow-up, they found significant increases in their left-to-right ratio in their prefrontal cortical activity. That after only 8 weeks of meditation practice as a formal intervention, 4 months later, they found this significant shift in their activity compared to the control group. They also found significant increase in their immune function compared to the control group. And actually, it was correlated with the increases in left to right prefrontal cortical activity, that there's something about these mind states that are connected, which makes sense, with your immune function. And so all of it's working together. So the implications of this are enormous. Many of you have heard about the happiness set point in psychology, that for the past 50 years, we've thought that just like we have a set point with our weight, and there's a kind of certain range you have, that there is a set point with your happiness level. And no matter what happened in life, you couldn't really shift it too much. And this idea grew out of research which showed that if you win the lottery or are in a terrible accident and become paralyzed, despite an initial change in the expected direction, your happiness returns to your relative baseline or set point. So it looks like this. Right, you win the lottery, you have this blip, and you're happy for a little bit. By the end of the year, you're back to your baseline. And what's extraordinary is the same thing happens if you're in a terrible accident. You have a significant negative decrease in your mood, and then you come back to baseline. If there hadn't been so much research showing this, no one would really believe it because it seems so counter to our logic, which is if we just make our external circumstances perfect, we'll be happy. Right? So this is kind of good news if you were born happy. Because it doesn't really matter what happens. Oh, I get divorced, I get hit by a car, it's no big deal. I just come back to my baseline. But for most of the people that we work with, they weren't born happy. And this can actually be an extraordinarily depressing finding, which is no matter what I do, I'm going to be depressed my whole life. That's my set point. And I remember reading about this, in college and in graduate school, this happiness set point, just saying, well, what's the point? How do we change? So what this research is showing is that although changing our external circumstances, buying a new house, winning the lottery, finding the perfect soulmate, doesn't bring lasting happiness, that training our mind, training our interior landscape, our internal circumstances, can have an effect, can shift our levels of happiness. Kind of makes you want to do cartwheels and somersaults. It's incredible. It's so hopeful. It's the most hopeful research that we've found, that this practice actually offers a path of liberation, of freedom, that works. As Richie Davidson says, happiness can be trained because the very structure of our brain can be modified. What he's talking about here is this new field of neuroplasticity. What he's referring to is this ability of the brain to change and learn throughout our lifetime. Up until the 1990s, we thought that the brain was static, that it stopped changing and growing after, by our early 20s, and that the brain you had was the brain you were stuck with for your whole life. But what we now recognize is that the brain is not static and fixed, that it can reorganize itself and form new connections. And basically, our repeated experiences are what shape our brain. And just like the monk told me when I was in Thailand, right now you're practicing anger and frustration and striving. And I was like, damn it, I've been here 6 days already. Right? What we practice is what we're cultivating. So again, how we're relating to our experience, no matter what our experience is, all of a sudden we're cultivating kindness, we're cultivating curiosity, we're cultivating gentleness. That's such a relief as you're practicing. So even if you're in the midst of a dark, deep sorrow, you know, I can still say to myself, I'm holding this with care, and I'm cultivating that kindness. I'm cultivating that compassion. They've done a few studies looking at long-term meditators and looking at their brain to see what is actually happening. Do their brains look different? Are we actually changing not only the activity, which is what we measured with the EEG and the activity in the prefrontal cortex, but actually the structure of the brain? And what they found in a study at Harvard conducted by Sarah Lazar is that experienced meditators have increased gray matter in their right anterior insula and in the prefrontal cortex, which are the parts of the brain involved in introspection, involved in reflection, involved in experiencing our inner mental states and also our physical states. So if I hooked you up to an EEG monitor and I said, focus on your breath, what would light up would be these parts of the prefrontal cortex and the right anterior insula. Further, this cortical thickening, which is just basically growth of your neurons, they're getting stronger and thicker. This growth was correlated with practice, that the more someone practiced, the thicker it was. And this isn't unique to meditation. When they look at taxi drivers, the parts of your brain that can visualize and map a city are thicker and stronger. And when they look at concert pianists and violinists, the parts that have to do with music are stronger. So what I also find exciting about this research, considering that I'm a mom and I'm not a nun and I work and I'm in the world, is that you don't have to be a monk to have these findings. Were with lay people who were married, who had children, who worked, who meditated an average of 40 minutes a day. You know, it wasn't tens of thousands of hours in a cave in the Himalayas. That this practice is really accessible and possible. All of us have the capacity to develop greater attention, compassion, and joy by training our mind. So, I'd like to shift to my third intention for tonight, which is to ask, how is this practice helpful? Clearly, there's something happening. What are the mechanisms? How is it helpful? What's actually happening? And I offer this as the beginning of a conversation, not as an answer. In fact, what I'll be presenting comes from a paper that I wrote and published in 2006 in the Journal of Clinical Psychology. And this is probably the most important paper for me that I've written. It came out of work that I was doing with my grandfather, who is 90 years old. And he has severe osteoarthritis. And maybe 8 years ago, he was in extraordinary amounts of pain and no medication was helping. And he was seeing all these specialists. And I moved up here to the Bay Area to be close to my grandparents. And they're a very important part of my life. So I said, Grandpa, you know, I travel all over the country working with people who are in chronic pain. And maybe I could teach you some of the practices that I'm teaching them. And he's extraordinarily open-minded. So he said, sure, his little granddaughter says, I can help you. So we started just having these practice sessions once a week, and I'd come over and we'd meditate. And my grandfather's a mathematician and a professor and probably one of the most brilliant human beings I've met. And so I was so curious about what his experience was of the mindfulness practices. And so we'd have these conversations, what's shifting, what's happening? And out of these conversations came what I'll be presenting, this model. So Benedict Friedman, the fourth author on this paper, is my grandfather. And after we wrote this theoretical paper, and it was published in this mainstream Journal of Clinical Psychology, I got a letter from the editor about a year after it was published, saying that it was the second most accessed article out of the 14,000 articles that year. So it's a special paper for a lot of reasons. And basically what my grandfather and I were discussing was this idea of what's happening as you're intentionally paying attention in this open, curious way. And what he noticed was that he started to have a shift in perspective toward his pain. And eventually what we called this was re-perceiving. He was re-perceiving. He was able to step outside of the experience, not detaching from it per se, but step outside of it and see it more clearly, not as his personal pain. Oh my God, how am I going to live with this? But interesting pain, just like you're doing here with all of your experience. And so re-perceiving, as we define it, is really this rotation in consciousness from subject to object, where instead of your subjective experience, my pain, my fear, my confusion, it becomes more objective. The pain, the fear, pain arising and passing. When we're able to disidentify with the contents of our consciousness, we're able to see them freshly, clearly, with greater objectivity. Rather than being immersed in the drama of our story, stories, you probably all have been immersed in those a little bit, we can see them and just witness them. Oh, I'm afraid that this pain's never going to go away. Right? As Dan Goleman says, the phenomena contemplated are distinct from the mind contemplating them. We begin to rest in this awareness that is holding our experience. And we recognize that if I'm able to see it, I must be more than it. You begin to recognize this pain is not me because I'm greater than this experience. There's a part of me that knows there's pain here. What's this part that knows? This awareness that knows. As Jon Kabat-Zinn will often ask, is my awareness of sadness sad? In my experience, no. It's just awareness. It's always already here, holding space for whatever arises. What's interesting, so my grandfather and I were talking about this, and I was getting really excited, and I called my friend John Aston, who's a developmental psychologist, and I said, John, wow, you know, I think we're onto something here. And this was maybe 5 or 6 years ago, and I told him about this, and he said, you know, this shift in perspective from subject to object is not new. He said, this is what children do all the time, right? This is considered key to development across the lifespan. You know, have you read Keegan or Piaget? And I was like, ooh, a long time ago, maybe. So he gives me a Psychology 101 textbook, and right there is this example. It's a mother's birthday. Her 3-year-old gives her a toy, perfectly developmentally appropriate. He is unable to see that his desires are separate and unique from his mother's. He's still completely caught in his egocentric reference point. Her 8-year-old gives her a bouquet of flowers. Such a good boy. He's had this shift just naturally without any meditation practice from his egocentric perspective, the everything subjective, it's all about me, to, oh, mom might like flowers instead of my truck. So as the child develops, this shift in perspective naturally occurs. And this is really the dawning of empathy. And this is just one step in a multi-step developmental process. And so what we believe is that mindfulness simply continues this normally, naturally occurring developmental human process. However, the shift in perspective has been expanded to include the contents of our own mind now, our own heart, our bodies, enabling us to make what was subject, my pain or my depression, object. As I said before, if I can see it, I must be more than it. We begin to recognize this pain is not me. When I worked for 5 years in a cancer center with women with breast cancer, and some of the most extraordinary healing would come from this experience of this cancer is not me. Yes, it's here. Yes, it's part of my experience. And there's something so much larger that's holding it. In this way, we transcend and include all of our experience, all aspects of our experience. And it's analogous to the 3-year-old example. However, now the disidentification, the re-perceiving, is from the contents of our mind. And this helps to shift our relationship to ourself. The self starts to be seen through and is realized more as a psychological construction, an ever-changing system of concepts, images, sensations, and beliefs. As the Buddha said, this does not belong to me. This am I not. This is not myself. This story that we hold on to so tightly that we're constantly protecting and defending. This is not myself. So as any good researcher, once you come up with a theory, you have to do a little bit of research on it. And luckily, statistics is not my favorite part of research. And to develop a measure of reperceiving, to quantify this, is extraordinarily challenging. And someone named David Fresco at Kent State University decided to develop a measure and develop this wonderful, reliable, valid measure of reperceiving and disidentification. And so we used it in a study at Spirit Rock for the people who are coming for the meditation retreat, the month-long, which is an extraordinary experience that I encourage all of you to explore at some point. So we looked at, does a month-long of intensive Vipassana meditation increase your ability to reperceive? We would hypothesize that it would. And what we found is comparing them to the control group who was going to be coming in March, there's a February retreat and a March retreat, it did indeed significantly increase this ability to reperceive pre and post retreat. What we also found, which was exciting and really supports this theory, is that the greater the shifts in the ability to reperceive, the greater the benefits. So the greater increases in well-being, the greater decreases in depression and anxiety. So that this really may be an important mechanism of action. Through shifting our perspective in this way, we're able to, it may be one of the transformative elements of this practice. And I'm sure all of you are beginning to experience that moment by moment. It's nothing too extraordinary. It's pretty subtle, and yet it's so significant. All of a sudden, and it's not detaching from our experience. It's not, oh, ho-hum, my pain over there. It's kind of this intimate detachment in some ways. Like you're zooming in, and you're really feeling your experience, and you're right there with it, and yet you're not so attached to it. And it's not about you or me or pushing it away or getting it to last. It's just what's arising in this moment. So there is a danger, I think, of becoming detached, and I see that happen, and I've experienced that in myself, where it's just like, oh, it's not me, and I put it over here, and I look at it with some distance. But as this practice, what I've found is that there's a way this practice helps me become so much more intimate with life. And I heard today so much in the interviews this desire to be embodied, to really feel our experience from the inside out. And in some ways, reperceiving allows you to do that because it's not so scary. There's a curiosity about your experience because there's no longer a story around it. And so instead of getting stuck in the story, you're able to drop into your direct experience. It's a kind of homecoming. What I'd like to mention here, and I don't always mention this when I'm giving a talk at a hospital or medical school, but I think it's important, is that this idea of reperceiving is just one part of a multi-step process, and that our developmental process and the meditation practice doesn't end at this subject-object shift, that it continues on until this separate sense of self is seen through and all conceptualization of subject versus object ends. Because what we're talking about here with reperceiving is a very dualistic perspective, right? Subject-object. And I think it's an actually extraordinarily important phase and process and aspect of meditation, and a really healing and helpful one. And it's one step in the process. We write, experience becomes simply knowing or perceiving from this non-dual perspective. There is no one perceiving and nothing being perceived, simply awareness happening. And this is the essence of the non-dual nature of mindfulness. Timothy Freke says, and it's very similar to what Ken Wilber writes too, actually, is that we begin as a baby and we're unconsciously one. It's all me, right? My mom's me, the world's me, everything's me. And then it's really important to go through this consciously separate stage. And then continuing on and moving back and forth to the experience of being consciously one, where there's no separate sense of self. This is a beautiful Hindu saying that captures it. When I forget who I am, I serve you. Through serving, I remember who I am and know I am you. So let's sit for a few moments. When I forget who I am, I serve you. Through serving, I remember who I am and know I am you. Thank you for your kind attention. It'll be a walking period now.